The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
It's not just that they've punted keeping the government open and the 702 reauthorization to mid-January. They've also punted a number of other issues to the beginning of next year. Again, things like CHIP, things like the flood insurance program. They did not resolve, for example, the DACA issue that remains out there. And so it's not just that come January, they're going to have to figure out how to keep the government open and how to reauthorize 702. It's that they have a number of other legislative deadlines that they also didn't resolve at the end of this year.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 22nd, 2017. It's nearly the end of the year, and we're still here because we have work to do, kind of like the Congress of the United States, which got to the end of 2017 without managing to reauthorize FISA 702. So they passed a 30-day extension, which in practice is probably more like an 8-day extension, given that they're not going to be here for much of the time. It's the politics of 702. It's wild and woolly, and I have my two next-door neighbors here to talk about it. Susan Hennessy, who forgets more in a week about 702 than most of us ever know, and Molly Reynolds, who works literally next door to me and is Brookings' resident expert on legislative politics. We're going to talk through all the kooky stuff that's been going on that's about to cause one of the country's most important intelligence programs to turn into a pumpkin. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 271. What the heck is up with 702? Hey, podcast listeners, reminder before we get started that next week is a We Answer Your Questions episode. Reminder how this works. You call in to the following number, 240-812-8498, and leave your question and say which Lawfare contributor you want to address it. And we will hunt that person down and we will make him or her answer your question on audio, and we will string them all together and make a really cool end of the year podcast out of it. So this is your chance, 240-812-8498. Leave us a message. All right, Susan, get us started. Congress has known about this deadline for a very long time, right? The end of the year is come, and the end of the legislative year has gone, and no 702 reauthorization, but a little extension. So bring us up to speed on the situation.
Yeah, so Congress has known for literally years about whenever this authority was going to sunset. That, you know, that said, it was always sort of, this was the legislative session that in which it was going to be reauthorized. So what we've seen over the course of the past 12 months is essentially sort of a series of escalating games of chicken by which there are hypothetical opportunities to reauthorize Section 702 in some form. There are sort of reform, civil liberties and privacy advocates that are looking for reform. There are the more sort of national security hawks that want to see it either reauthorized in its clean reauthorization, so reauthorized as it currently exists, even some proposals to actually make it permanent, so reauthorize it as it currently exists, and also get rid of that sunset provision. So sort of we've been through a few cycles now in which we've had, dueling bills introduced. None of those have actually come up for votes yet. And all along, we've sort of been ticking towards this December 31st deadline. Actually, it's December 30th at midnight is technically when the authority lapses. Now, this is all against the backdrop of there are annual certifications that are set to lapse in April. So there's a little bit, we're about to fall off essentially a mini cliff. The big cliff comes in April whenever the actual certifications that allow ongoing targeting under Section 702 expire. So, but it is still frankly shocking that we've gotten to this point. Congress has decided to do a very brief reauthorization. So basically they're just extending the sunset date until January 19th. That's going to buy them a little bit of time. It still isn't clear what the compromise legislation might look like, which team is sort of stronger here, and sort of every single day it's getting more likely that we're going to get to the point where the actual authority lapses entirely.
Okay, so a few things. One is I have to say this. You say it is completely shocking, and I want you to be on record. Who has been saying that exactly this was going to happen for more than 6 months?
So a lot of people, but specifically one, Benjamin Wittes, expressly predicted, I believe, this exact thing was going to happen. We had a conversation in June or July about it.
Yeah, I've been saying to almost anyone who would listen, FISA 702 is going to expire.
And look, to your credit, I have been saying, look, the Republicans control the Senate, the House, the White House. They've been totally hawkish on national security. I mean, it's not possible they would allow 702 to lapse.
I mean, this has been, as someone who pays a lot of attention to Congress, this has been a year where I've heard people say that same thing about lots of other policy issues. So we've been saying that about the Children's Health Insurance Program, which expired at the end of September. And, people spent 9 months saying CHIP's not going to expire because CHIP never expires. So this is a refrain, I think, that extends beyond just this particular policy
2017,
issue.
2017, the year all the things that don't expire expired.
Like, even outside sort of the legislative process, we're seeing other things that might actually make reauthorizing 702 a heavier lift. So just today it was announced that FBI General Counsel Jim Baker, someone who has really been a key sort of within the government in sort of in pushing reauthorization, ensuring the Hill is informed, having those kinds of public engagements. There were a lot of people who did that during the Obama administration. So Bob Litt, who was the General Counsel of ODNI, took a very forward-leaning approach on sort of the 215 reauthorization. Sort of Comey, former FBI Director Comey, was the person who I think most people assumed would be sort of, doing the 702 circuit this year. Obviously, things didn't play out that way. So it's required. It's already been a really complex policy space. Baker really has stepped up to the plate in a really important way for the intelligence community, the FBI, and the government. Now to hear that he is going to be reassigned within the FBI amidst a lot of pressure from Hill Republicans against sort of the FBI senior leadership, that I think throws things even more into turmoil and question.
So, memo to the administration, if you want to get your legislative priorities through Congress, best practices do not include firing and removing all the people who are carrying the ball on it. Just a thought. So, Susan, before we go on into the sort of depths of the legislative politics, for those listeners who are new to this subject, give us a little 702 primer. What is it, and why should we care?
Right. So very shortly, because we've talked about this quite a bit on the podcast, and I would recommend to Lawfare podcast listeners listening to a previous podcast we've done with Jim Baker and Carl Gaddis at the FBI. That's kind of a deep dive on the program. But essentially, this is the program by which the U.S. intelligence community targets foreigners located abroad, their communications by serving process on U.S. service providers. So there are lots of complex questions related to incidental collection. Most of the controversy surrounds the whenever you interact with U.S. persons' communications. But essentially, this is the program that likely produces the most amount of information that goes into things like the president's daily brief. Right, it's a critical sort of counterterrorism authority. It's something that that really is, it touches on every single part of the intelligence community's mission. So, anything from foreign policy, sanctions, compliance, sort of it pops up everywhere in the national security world.
So one more thing, you alluded to this earlier. The authority to seek new certifications is what expires. But that does not mean the intelligence community suddenly goes dark. So just sketch out for us what are the dates on which bad things start happening if 702 is not reauthorized.
Right. So there's one thing to keep in mind, and that's that there's not like a 702 light switch in the basement of Fort Meade that
it's more
you turn
of a dimmer.
Right, slowly. The intelligence community, and specifically the attorneys within the intelligence community, are quite insistent that at the moment the statutory authority lapses, you no longer have the authority to collect something, you have to be 100% in compliance. So whenever we think about any of these deadlines, you have to build in a couple of weeks in advance. The intelligence community is always pretty cagey about sort of the precise number of days they need, but we're talking about something on the order of, you know, 3 or 4 weeks in advance of the deadlines. So what's going to happen previously on December 31st, but now on January 19th, is the underlying statutory authority. So the thing that allows the government to go to the FISC and obtain authorization, that is going to lapse. So the government will no longer be able to do that. However, because authorizations are issued on an annual basis, there are still existing non-expired authorizations. So the last set of authorizations were obtained on April 26th of last year. So that means that theoretically, the underlying statute could lapse, 702 could go away, and you could still have a good authorization, right? So you could still have sort of the authority to undertake ongoing collection, even if you weren't allowed to undertake new collection. Now, this is not a settled sort of question of law. There is some precedent, and most precedent goes in the government's favor, that yes, it is sort of kosher to continue to rely on the existing annual certification. We can see evidence of how uncomfortable DOJ is with that position because they insisted on getting this 2-week there's 30-day reauthorization, right? The government is really not comfortable being put in the position, mostly because it's going to open them up to litigation risks. So as soon as there's an open question about whether or not providers have to comply, we can expect that some providers will say, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're going to actually challenge this in court. Even if the government thinks it'll probably win ultimately on the merits, it really doesn't want to be investing time and resources and frankly just the risk by allowing those sorts of questions to open. But technically, the government has indicated that, let's say the program did lapse entirely, or it does lapse entirely on January 19th, they do intend to continue to collection up until that April 26th date.
And can they go into the FISC on January 18th and say, please renew for the next year so that they actually buy themselves a year rather than a few months?
So this is a question and a solution some people have floated. The government has been quite clear that they do not intend to pursue that strategy. This is not about sort of getting through by a loophole. If Congress does not want this program to be authorized, if it does not want the intelligence community to undertake this form of collection, something that on a broad bipartisan basis, most people agree this is a critical and important authority, even those that sort of support reform at the margins. But I do think it's the pretty clear position of the executive branch. Look, you know, we're not going to play cute with Congress. If they aren't prepared to reauthorize this authority, then we're all going to have to live with the consequences of that. Now, don't do that. Let's reauthorize the program. But even if you technically could do that, even if you could get a FIS judge to sign off on it, you know, an even sort of bigger question, the government's been clear that they aren't playing that game.
All right, Molly. So you're responsible for everything Congress does.
Absolutely. That's my title here at Brookings, person who's responsible for Congress.
How does this happen? As the law has, we've all known the law was, you know, had an expiration date. We've all known what that was for years. The intelligence community and members of both parties are broadly in agreement that if coverage of this statute lapses for even a very short time, that presents an exigent national security emergency. How does it happen that Congress is so dysfunctional that it is even a question as to whether this lapses in practice?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple different levels at which we want to answer that question. So there's a point to be made about kind of the overall environment of the current Congress, of Congress in 2017, and what's been happening throughout the year. So one thing that Republicans in Congress decided to do with their unified control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency was take on a couple of big major legislative priorities and do so on a party line basis. So first it was health care, then it was the tax bill. And they did those in a way that meant they didn't have to work with Democrats. So that sort of set a kind of baseline attitude for the year and also just sort of consumed nearly all of the oxygen on Capitol Hill. So that's kind of the overall atmosphere in which this was happening. And they were really focused, particularly after the failure of the healthcare bill, on getting that tax bill done, which again meant that that's what everyone was paying attention to. And it was really overshadowing the need to get a number of other things, including 702 reauthorization, but things like the Children's Health Insurance Program, the expiration of the Flood Insurance Program, a big veterans health bill, all that kind of stuff.
Keeping the government open.
Keeping the government open.
DACA,
all kinds of things. I actually think DACA is a sort of interesting comparison case here because it's something that has kind of a deadline that's out there, but there's a lot of disagreement among the policy community about, you know, what are the consequences of that actual March deadline versus what's already happening given that they're not taking new applications. But anyway, so there's all this stuff that they were had deadlines coming up on, and the sort of political drive to finish the tax legislation just really overshadowed all of them. And then it got to a point where at the beginning of December, we had all of these pieces, and there's an analogy that people sometimes use when they talk about Congress about a Christmas tree bill, where people try to hang lots of ornaments on them, and if you hang too many ornaments on them, the whole bill falls down. I think in this case, it was more just there were so many possible ornaments, no one really knew which ones we were going to pair together to get this done. So that's kind of what's been happening over the past several weeks.
And just to be clear, I mean, there were a number of things that, like 702, had built-in end-of-the-year deadlines.
And we actually generally think that deadlines work in can work in Congress's favor. So there's a reason why, for example, you brought up earlier the idea that 702 has a periodic fixed-term authorization. So the last time they renewed it for some amount of time. They didn't make it permanent. And we think that that can be a good thing for Congress generally. It gives them a reason to revisit policy questions. But when you can't actually use that deadline to force yourselves to take the necessary action and the necessary review, then That's not helpful at all.
And whenever we sort of, we obviously the tax bill became the priority. There was no deadline sort of in the tax code for reforming that. You know, was there, whenever we think about how we can read legislative priorities and particularly national security legislative priorities into the choices here, you know, was it, you know, assume that you're someone who really does want to see tax legislation, this tax legislation passed. Was it a reasonable choice or the only choice to put the tax bill now? Would it have been just as likely to be passed whenever they got back in January, right? So sort of putting yourself in the mindset of actually sharing the, you know, the policy goal, you know, whether or not any of the three of us do, you know, how big of a statement is it that, you know, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan said, let's do taxes first, let's do 702 and everything else later, or rather not do them before their deadlines?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think that the choice to do the tax bill this year and to really focus on that being the priority was a political choice. So there's nothing procedural that meant that they couldn't wait until 2018 to do the tax bill. And I think what many folks maybe thought was going to happen is they were going to get the tax bill done, and then they weren't necessarily going to have all of the problems that they did making the other pieces fit together in the past week or so. And we can kind of talk about why it is that 702 ended up being a somewhat problematic piece of that overall puzzle. But I think that if you are someone who cares a lot about taxes, it was important politically to get that done before the end of the year, but there's nothing about the policy that would have kind of changed if you waited until January to do it instead.
Okay, so Molly, walk us through what in fact Congress did, because they actually folded it into the whole government shutdown.
Yep.
So now we have a government shutdown issue merged with a 702 shutdown issue. Those didn't used to be connected. Now they are. What exactly happened procedurally?
Sure. So, the story in some ways begins in September when the government's fiscal year ends. And so every year before the 1st of October, Congress has to take some sort of action to keep the government running in the new fiscal year. This year, they decided in September to do a short-term continuing resolution, which basically is just a sort of the government's version of autopilot. It says everything that was already happening can keep going with the same amount of money that was directed at it before. Sometimes they'll write in a little bit of language to make a couple tweaks around the edges, but it's basically just we're going to keep going where we were before. So in September, they passed a continuing resolution that ran through the 8th of December. Come early December, everyone realized that they weren't going to have their act together to do anything longer term. And so they did another short 2-week continuing resolution, which was scheduled to run out tonight, the 22nd at midnight. So they needed to do something to keep the lights on past midnight tonight. And one thing that we've seen a lot of in Congress in recent years is using these must-pass spending bills, these bills that are meant to keep the government open, to prevent a government shutdown, as a way to try to move other legislative priorities. And so in this case, one of those other legislative priorities was the 702 reauthorization. That's how it ended up getting folded in with this, this particular spending bill. The spending bill that they passed this week that has the short-term 702 reauthorization itself runs out on January 19th. Importantly, it's not just that they've punted keeping the government open and the 702 reauthorization to mid-January. They've also punted a number of other issues to the beginning of next year. Again, things like CHIP, things like the flood insurance program. They did not resolve, for example, the DACA issue. That remains out there. And so it's not just that come January, they're going to have to figure out how to keep the government open and how to reauthorize 702. It's that they have a number of other legislative deadlines that they also didn't resolve at the end of this year.
So sort of predicting the future, so the House has now announced they're not going to come back in session until the 8th. What you've described is essentially a bandwidth issue at the end of this year. There just wasn't enough time and floor time in order to get all of these bills passed, particularly with people like Rand Paul and Ron Wyden threatening to filibuster. It now seems like they've moved all of the same pieces to the same day in the future. They then have 8 days. So they come back January 8th. They have the same problems that they couldn't surmount this week. What happens?
The oil that was supposed to burn for 1 day will burn for 8 days, and they'll be fine.
I mean, that's one option, Ben. Another one that's probably more likely is that I would frankly be somewhat surprised if by January 19th we've actually resolved all of these issues, in part because one of the sort of big overarching unanswered questions is not just kind of how to allocate federal resources across programs, but frankly, how much overall money the federal government is going to spend next year. So thanks to something called the Budget Control Act that was passed in 2011, there are caps on discretionary federal spending. Basically, not everyone, but close to everyone is unhappy with those caps, thinks they should be higher. And so the first step in kind of resolving the government funding piece of this is for Republicans and Democrats to come to an agreement on what those overall limits should be. My guess is that between now and January 19th, that's really going to be the focus on the spending side. So the first thing that will happen is that they will try to get that agreement. And it may well be the case that they need another short-term spending bill. I'm saying all this because what I sort of envision early in the year is another series of kind of must-pass important votes that other things, including potentially 702, may get attached to. One thing that we did hear this week that will be interesting to watch is one of the points that was discussed by members about approaching 702 is a sort of demand from some, I think particularly House members, for a separate debate on 702 on the floor where they would be able to offer amendments to the bill. And that kind of argument about members getting a chance to amend bills as part of a much broader kind of debate between rank and file, particularly House Republicans and the House Republican leadership. House Republican rank and file members think that they don't have enough input into how legislation works. And so it wasn't particularly surprising to me to see that come out as one of the cleavages here on an issue that, as I understand it, actually has some really interesting cleavages that don't line up neatly along partisan lines.
Okay, so let's this is actually a very interesting backdoor way into the question of what is actually in dispute here? Because, like, with spending, I understand Democrats and Republicans disagree, right? With CHIP, there's presumably some actual policy disagreement that underlies it. But, 702, everybody purports to want to reauthorize it with very few exceptions. And while there are some civil libertarians of both the left and the right who want reforms of certain aspects of it, particularly with respect to backdoor searches. My impression is that if you had a vote on reauthorizing 702, it passes pretty substantially in both houses of Congress. And so I'm interested, Susan, in your sense of what are we really fighting about with respect to 702, and who at this point are the sides?
So I think this is partly a question that I still have in my mind, and that's that whenever sort of this, we're in a pause period right now, when the debate reopens, what does it reset to, right? Are we back to where we were before midnight yesterday? Are we sort of have we totally reopened the debate? So what we've seen is a number of bills sort of emerge. So first there was legislation that came out of the SSCI, multiple forms of legislation, some offered by Senator Wyden. I think it's fair to describe those as sort of non-starters in the sense that they had reforms that are fundamentally operationally unacceptable to the IC and are very, very unlikely to pass. As well as a bill out of the SSCI that had some sort of marginal reforms, but really was more or less clean reauthorization, as well as a bill from Senator Cotton to basically make it a permanent law. Then we had the House Judiciary Committee. So there's also turf wars within the committees because the intelligence committees feel like they have ownership of 702 because it's an intelligence collection authority. The Judiciary Committees that oversee the FBI, because the particular controversy is related to the FBI's use of this information, they feel like they have a very big stake in this as well. So you've definitely seen some conflicts between the committees. So we saw a House Judiciary bill that came out that sort of had very substantive reforms about a limited area of sort of backdoor searches, you know, whether or not what's known as post-collection queries. So the NSA collects information under the broad 702 authority. It's then shared with federal agencies, including the FBI, and the controversy is over what is the legal standard or process that has to occur before the FBI can query the databases that it has of 702 information for U.S. persons information. Basically, you know, it runs the range from they just get to do it anytime they want to they actually need to seek a warrant from a judge. So the HJC put this bill out. A lot of discussion about that. Ultimately, what we saw as we were moving up closer and closer to the deadline and through November was sort of rumors that, hey, this HPSI bill was going to strike the big compromise. So they were going to take the SSCI legislation, they were going to take the HJC legislation, and sort of whatever the HPSI put out, that was going to be the thing that they were going to try and get through using some vehicle like the spending bill at the end of the year. So everyone was sort of waiting to see where did the HPSI bill fall. When the HPSI bill was released, it looked a lot more like those SSCI clean reauthorization bills than it did like the HJC bill. So that was a pretty big signal sort of from at least Intel committee leadership on a bicameral basis that, hey, we're not doing the major reform game. Sort of the path that we're going to try and pursue here is basically reauthorize the program as it exists, add a little bit of sort of transparency, accountability reforms on the margin, and try and get it through. So what we saw earlier this week was an attempt to take that HPSI bill, put it on other must-pass legislation. That failed. So my question, and Molly, I don't know if you have an answer to this yet, is, okay, now as we take another bite at the apple, what apple are we taking a bite at? Are we going back to the HPSI legislation because, hey, all that compromise, you know, occurred? Or because the deadline is no longer there, the deadline is different, are we going to reopen all those questions? I mean, I know that's sort of a political as much as procedural, but what's your sense of what ordinarily or often happens?
Yeah, so one thing that I think is really important to think about in this context is, so getting at something that Ben said before about, you know, there's broad consensus on reauthorizing 702, but there are some folks on both the left and the right who feel really strongly about this, is that it gets down to a sort of preferences versus intensity of preferences debate. And so to the extent that there are some members, and whether they come from the sort of ideological left or the ideological right, who feel very strongly about their position on this issue, particularly when Congress is facing a deadline and is trying to do a very choreographed dance around the time that they have, if you have very intense preferences and you're willing to try and derail that careful dance, that gives you a lot of leverage. Excuse me. And so I think that that may be one of the dynamics that we are seeing at play here. I think a second thing to keep in mind is the degree to which the factions that perhaps objected to the original plan this week overlap with other factions within Congress who are who need to be mollified on other issues. And so here I'm thinking about, you know, the potential of, say, some of the conservative House Republicans who perhaps both object, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to some of the provisions in the possible 702 reauthorizations, but also object to other things related to, say, keeping the government open. And so you Republican leaders end up having to try to sort of trade across these issues once they've already tried to link them.
I'll give you 702 for Chip.
Yeah, or just things like that generally. And that's another consequence of kind of all of these issues colliding together.
Right. You end up with horse trading of totally unrelated equities, right?
Right. And of things that people have wildly different intensities of preferences about.
Okay, so let's that's actually a good place to sort of go to, you know, kind of wrap up in a what happens in January kind of way. Okay, so we have 8 days in January. What do we expect to see happen in that time with respect to 702? Do you think it's reasonable to get a reauthorization for some period of time, some real period of time? Do you kick it down the road again with another kind of CR or very short-term extension? Or do you actually have a floor debate on a standalone bill in either of both houses in which people get to do what, of course, should have happened over the last year and a half, which is debating 702?
Right. So on that last question, if it is the case that the primary demand for a real debate on 702 reauthorization is in the House has more ability to kind of control and schedule its floor time than the Senate does. And so if Paul Ryan thought that a way to solve this or any number of his other problems was devoting some amount of floor time to debating 702 reauthorization in early January, I think he could make that happen. I don't know if that's what's going to happen, but I think that is one option. One other point that I want to make that kind of gets at why this has been really tricky is that because this is an issue that doesn't break down neatly along partisan lines, it's not one that Congress is terribly well equipped to deal with in the kind of modern, the contemporary Congress, where either everything is partisan or everything is incredibly bipartisan and everyone agrees. And so when you can't use kind of the usual heuristics and shortcuts for deal making across the parties, I think that's part of why both we got to the point where we are and also why I don't have a great answer about exactly what happens next.
What is your prediction, Susan?
I don't know. I'm surprised to be in this position sort of in the first place. I don't have a procedural prediction. My prediction is still that 702 is in fact reauthorized, that reauthorization looks more like sort of the SSCI-HPC model than any of the more aggressive reform efforts that we've seen. I think that the privacy and civil liberties groups really have attempted to use this second April deadline as a reason to sort of say, no, don't let them, don't let them force you into voting now. Don't let them, you don't have to capitulate because, you have this April deadline. I think it's totally possible that we will see another short-term deadline that moves us closer to what is the real cliff, and that actually might incentivize people to act a little bit differently. That said, I think it's worth noting that 2018 is an election year, and this is a controversial issue, and it's a controversial issue in ways that are not predictably partisan. People have sort of strongly felt and sometimes unpredictable views on these things. And so I do think that the closer you push to November, the more likely it becomes that this sort of the marginal controversies or the surmountable controversies now really become entrenched issues. We've seen, sort of notwithstanding really White House and executive branch and intelligence community efforts to get this reauthorization done, we've seen President Trump be incredibly counterproductive on it, raising lots of questions about sort of intelligence community abuses, really making it difficult for
the
FBI.
Are you belittling the unmasking controversy, Susan?
So one of the things that actually got the HPSI bill sort of free from the committee ultimately was these very, very silly provisions that Devin Nunes had insisted on including about sort of an unmasking controversy, a controversy that most people in the intelligence community recognize as wholly fictitious and really designed to mollify President Trump. What the executive branch did, because they were so concerned about sort of the unintended or inadvertent consequences of this not particularly careful legislative language, was they said, okay, we will do unmasking reform at an executive order level. So we'll give you everything you want, all the silly things you want to address your silly fake controversy in order to get it pulled out of the legislation. So that was one thing that people had sort of grasped onto as saying, hey, you know, that's, you know, the HPSI bill actually does have a chance here. But I just think, you know, don't underestimate the particularly dysfunction in the House and sort of this dysfunction that comes out of the president that tends to be centered on the intelligence community practices. Over the next year, as we know, Special Counselor Mueller's investigation will continue. Investigations in the Senate, potentially in the House, are going to continue. It will potentially become wrapped up as an election year issue. And so, to my mind, every day that we get closer to November, it's going to make this a heavier lift, which is why, you know, we're really moving into playing a pretty dangerous and potentially incredibly consequential game.
Yeah, and this dynamic that you highlighted, Susan, about the degree to which President Trump has perhaps made legislative agreement on this issue more difficult is not, again, unique to, I want to kind of put this in a little bit of context, it's not unique to 702. One of the things that's been kind of particularly interesting to watch as someone who pays a lot of attention to Congress is that usually we think that same party presidents of the congressional majority have some power to help those congressional majorities bridge internal differences, and there are many among the Congressional Republican Party, and that is something we just have not seen happen in a very effective way this year. So this concern that you have about kind of an election year and the degree to which President Trump presents challenges for Republicans in building a coalition around this is, again, not unique to this particular issue.
Well, my prediction, for whatever it's worth, is that FISA 702 will actually expire in January, if only for a short period of time, because it will take an expiration in order to create the atmosphere of crisis that will cause Congress to act rather than to kick the can. And I don't think you'll have a lapse of coverage, but I do think you will have we will have to go through the exercise of letting it expire and letting people freak out and make dire warnings in order for Congress to be able to muster the political will and energy to focus in the same direction. On that cheerful note, Molly Reynolds, Susan Hennessy, thank you so much for joining us. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution, which today supplied all, for the first time, of our guests on the Lawfare Podcast. So thanks this week to the Brookings Institution for being the Brookings Institution. You need to do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast in all those ways that you do: Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, 4chan, all those other social media services that you use. Our music is, of course, played by the one, the only, the in Washington this week, Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.